Welcome to Transmissions, a podcast of the Blackwood Gallery at the University of Toronto, Mississauga. My name is Laura Tibi, and I'm the educator in residence here at the Blackwood. This podcast begins by covering Burning Glass, Reading Stone, a series of exhibitions across four light boxes on the UTM campus, running from September 2020 through June 2021. As fall semester brings students, faculty, and staff back to campus for a tentative return, it's important we reflect on how we think of and engage with the campus amidst the global pandemic. As the current pandemic has reconfigured nearly every aspect of our collective lives, making more apparent than ever the social, economic, and environmental disparities in our world, we can begin by acknowledging the land on which the University of Toronto Mississauga operates, acknowledging that this is stolen, exhausted, and occupied land that has been inhabited, stewarded, and cared for by the Huron-Wendat, the Seneca, and most recently the Mississaugas of the Credit River, and that it continues to be the meeting place and home to Indigenous people from across Turtle Island. Burning Glass, Reading Stone explores the conditions, spaces, and technologies of looking, especially in a hyper-mediated COVID world. It asks what habits of looking has social distancing made clear, what responsibilities do images ask of us, what responsibilities do they occlude, and how can various modes of looking, whether they be scientific, testimonial, or documentary, refocus our collective attention. Each segment of the Lightbox series will feature a reader in residence in dialogue with the images on display. This podcast forms one part of our reader in residence program featuring the reader and the artist in question-driven conversation. The reader will then respond to the image series in the form of a reading, a set of images, a performance, a musical score, or another form of interpretation. In this episode, reader in residence Lori Kang will speak with Oscar Sentian about his image set titled Solaris. Sentian is very much interested in the relationship between nature and intelligence, and Solaris asks how we might begin to see nature as an intelligent life form. The photographs Sentian takes are of the Atacama Desert in Chile, known for its extremely arid climate. He made these images by gathering sand grains from the desert, melting them into glass, and then turning the glass into photographic lenses, which he calls desert eyes. He then uses these lenses to photograph the desert landscape. And so in this way, the desert takes on a level of consciousness by looking back at itself and partaking in the making of its own images. Solaris therefore confronts us with the proposition that nature is capable of thinking, challenging the idea that nature is a passive object of contemplation. Oscar Sentian is an artist and cybernetician living in the Netherlands and Ecuador, and Lori Kang is a Toronto-based artist whose practice engages with queer theory, science fiction, and biology. Without further ado, let's hear the conversation between Oscar and Lori.
Hi, Oscar.
Hi, Lori. Nice seeing you here.
Yeah, nice to see you virtually as well. So I wanted to start by setting the environment of the work, Solaris. And like any good sci-fi novel or film, I want to hear from your end what your atmosphere was as you were making this work. And also maybe this is a way for me to ask about your concept of anti-mundo. Mm-hmm. Am I pronouncing that properly?
Anti-mundo, yes. No,
anti-mundo. Yeah. Okay, yeah, which is, it's been written as a methodology that is a matrix containing sci-fi, indigenous worlding, and cybernetics that can be sensed as a way of identifying and generating realities that do not fit in the world. And I found this really compelling, and I guess I want to start with that and ask if you could tell me more about this methodology and the backstory of its emergence, what your atmosphere was at the time that this term became a mode of seeing, thinking, and making for you.
Yeah, so, all right. So I feel like we're going to be speaking at this point about two things. One would be Solaris, and the other one would be Antimundo, right? And then I would like to perhaps just for the general public that may be listening this or watching this, just to go into some basics about Solaris, the material mm-hmm. of it, what is it all about, and kind of like the premises in that novel that really it drew me into it.
Mm-hmm.
So the shortest possible version I can make of it is that so Solaris is a 1961 novel written by a Polish writer, philosopher, Stanisław Lem. And the novel has been, perhaps people more often knows it through the Tarkovsky film. Hopefully mm-hmm. they know it by the Tarkovsky film from the 1970s and not through the Soderbergh's film from the, I think, 1990s. So because the Tarkovsky film, it's a beautiful film. I would say for the purposes of my take on Solaris or my Solaris version, the film in itself wasn't particularly helpful for one reason, and is it that Tarkovsky put more emphasis into the psychological aspects of the characters rather than in the scientific and I would say the scientific aspects that really shape the narrative in the novel. So in that regard, I'm talking about atmosphere, the Stanisław Lem novel feels fairly different than the Tarkovsky novel, which of course is totally all right. It's not much of a moral judgment, as it's just simply an acknowledgement of certain characteristics where they differ. And the basics, if I could just briefly go into describing what the novel goes about, there is this astronaut or cosmonaut, rather, as the Soviets used to call their astronauts. So there is this cosmonaut that is sent to see what is going on in this artificial satellite that the Soviets had placed in this faraway planet. So it's a planet outside of our solar system. So it's an exoplanet. At this planet, it is already known for 50 years. So there have been many missions sent already there. There is an entire decades of research done in this on this planet. And what has been clear is that the ocean of the planet is intelligent, that is self-conscious indeed, not only intelligent, but it is self-conscious. But here it is like the two main points for me and about why this novel in particular really drew my attention. Mm-hmm. One reason is that in the Solaris novel, this intelligent, the presence of a self-conscious being that doesn't have a brain already defies our mainstream notions of thinking, where for centuries, at least in mainstream Western scientific thinking, or even beyond, really, you could even find traces of what I'm about to say, probably in the Bible as well, in terms of the Bible being a book that is so anthropocentric. So what is it? So basically you have this ocean that is self-conscious, and it means that the intelligence in this entity is decentralized, unlike the intelligence of mammals that is the one that for centuries has been acknowledged in Western thinking as the capital letters, the thinking entity, the brain. So that's one aspect of the novel, but this is fairly revolutionary, you would say. This is published in 1961. And the other aspect is that this intelligent ocean is not interested on interacting with humans. Mm-hmm. So for decades, these cosmonauts have tried over and over and over to get in touch with, in contact with the ocean. So that's again, really interesting because again, it defies mainstream assumptions and also it pushes the sci-fi genre in that sense, where the main the usual narratives were about extraterrestrials coming and supposedly finding us so interesting, so important, so relevant that they have to come here to talk to us, to save us from self-destruction. That was usually the theme. And this is very, very different. This ocean is just simply not interested in humans.
Right. Which is so interesting because it's like, you know, the fantasy of an author writing this story of extraterrestrials coming and finding us as a species so interesting is this exoticization and this reverse colonization. And then in this sense, with the water that's in essence refusing to be colonized, that's something that's super interesting about that.
Yeah, that's totally right. I think we could even say that call it like a third aspect of these main topics in the narrative, at least in the way we look at it from our perspective in this here and now. So in that regard, that's kind of like a short introduction to Solaris. And then I think we're going to have time later on to talk about a little bit what was my take when this turned or this became an art project. But going back now to the question about the methodology, about the main methodology that I'm using for or the framework that I'm using, Antimundo. So this anti-world, what it is. So I define it as a way of putting emphasis on those aspects of reality that are overlooked. So to really work with what is in the margins, and being the case that I'm an artist who is interested in the dialogue between art and science, what I felt that was missing is, you know, this is the main critique I personally have against modern science. And this is not much about the very foundations of it, which is, you know, the relationship between evidence and the way in which the scientific method processes that evidence and works with it in search for truth. I think that method of working of modern science is absolutely brilliant, and it produces unquestionable results. So what is the, and I want to emphasize that because, you know, I think when we go into criticizing science, I think it's really important to pinpoint what is it that, which aspect is it that we are criticizing, not to play along with extreme right narratives that are rather, they're not criticizing science. They're I would say they are rather just discrediting science. So I do not want to go into discrediting science. I want to I think because of the current context, I think it's very important to make that clear.
Yeah, I appreciate that because I have the, you know, I'm super inspired by science and technology studies and texts and papers that I read, which, as you said, really exists at the fringes of the medium. You know, they're papers written by scientists who aren't necessarily artists, but I like you, I'm really interested in that intersection of science and arts because science has all this information in the structure, but what I think they often leave out or what they don't focus on too much is the imaginative potential, like, you know, quantum physics, there's all these insane leaps that are happening. And, you know, then you have writers that talk about it from a queer perspective or, and that things that what art enables is that kind of imagination. But I did not even think, as you mentioned, of the other direction of like critiquing science as discrediting. So I appreciate you bringing that up.
Yeah, I mean, I think in context, especially when we are reaching larger audiences, I think it's very important to do this. And I think often I experience it myself in discussions and arguments with colleagues who come from, for instance, some decolonial perspectives that I'm familiar with and I'm partially affiliated to those sort of worldviews. But I feel that sometimes the scope for the criticism is so broad that it's not really helpful in the end. Basically the point that I want to make, and going back to the Antimundo idea, is that what I aim to do is to by going back into looking at sources, at research done in the history of science, to see what is it that has been left outside of the understanding or scientific narratives throughout time. And you see that because science is made by human beings, many of the prejudices that have been mainstreaming our societies for a long, long time have been present also there. This has caused the exclusion of, for instance, of women in science, of all type of minorities. You see also in my own case, I'm very devoted towards studying the history of science in Latin America, especially, and science fiction from Latin America as well. And you see how is it that modern science, one of the critiques, for instance, about what was left outside, is that basically the narrative was stated so that there is this kind of fantasy as if modern science began with Newton. And then of course, according to the story, some figures were opening up the gates basically for Newton to pop up, right? Like Copernico, like Galileo, like Kepler. And finally you have here the guy that is gonna open the gates for humanity to enter into a new time of enlightenment. And no doubt that these achievements are really remarkable, but as much as light was brought into the scenery, many shadows were cast as well. Mm-hmm. And what is there in those shadows, right? So I would say what I call Antimundo is what science for a long time didn't consider to be part of or contributors to those discourses and to those achievements. And then in terms of history also, you know, when you look back into the history of science, and the history of science really, you know, is so interesting to see where the foundations are for the scientific revolution of modern science, because then you really have to start looking first into the Arab world, mm-hmm. And the Islamic Golden Age. Then you have to look into China, and really it's so interesting, for instance, to see how the colonization of the Americas couldn't have happened without Europeans having gained access to Chinese technology.
Right.
Just to put something into context, in the 15th century, which is, you know, by the end of the 15th century, Columbus famously travels to the Americas. Maritime technology of Europeans allows them to make the word is not boats, but how would you call galleons and ships? Ships, yeah, of certain size. While China at the same time Chinese engineers were capable of building ships 10 times longer. Europeans couldn't make it because they didn't have the scientific knowledge for that. So actually there's, you know, same with gunpowder, and when you start the compass as well, paper, when you start looking into the technologies enabling Europeans to colonize the Americas, you have to...
It's very complicated.
Yeah, you have to look back into where these technologies come from. And most of them do not come from Europe, really. They come from the Arab world, they come from China. So it's a really interesting situation when we start looking about what has been left out from the narrative, right?
Yeah, I like that description of Antimundo in that way of what's in the margins, and it, you know, I was kind of picturing you as a gleaner in a way, like, you know, when you glean or you sift through, and what is left out of that, or what is left behind from that, and that image of you, of that, like, the image of a gleaner in that way feels relevant here. And also just thinking about what I was hearing you talk about was the kind of non-neutrality of science as a medium, as a structuring medium, as a knowledge producing medium that involves bodies that are not neutral as well, that, you know, inclusion inevitably entails exclusions, and science doesn't take those exclusions into account on the macro level of, like, the people doing the research and knowledge production, and even, and often at a microscopic level of the tools, the hands that manipulate the tools as not being, those are not neutral things as well. So yeah. I'm really interested in that kind of, like, your emphasis to think about, you know, this, the desire to apprehend in the construction of modern science versus your practice of complexifying in a way through looking at what is left behind, or what is left out, or what is in the margins, as you say. And that made me think of another question that I had about the work, about the literal work of the of Solaris, with the what you call desert eyes, which are made of the melted down sand from the Atacama Desert. And just thinking about, you know, the margins or the in-between, I wanted to ask you to speak about this idea of impurity again, and maybe that goes along with maybe I'm thinking of gleaning because of the sand as well, but speak about impurity and how, because the sand that you got cast into glass wasn't filtered thoroughly, so it has the impurities in embedded into this transformed state that it's in now. So can you talk about impurities, how it relates to porous membranes, insides and outsides, what you think about those things.
Yeah, so this is actually a really, really interesting point for reflection. Let me just make a quick note before I move into trying to answer this question. And it's that, the Antimundo vision is informed. I just wanted to mention this because it's really informed by the work of scientists themselves. So there is a kind of, within science, there have always been contrarians like Lynn Margulis, for instance. And I would say that she is, for me, as for many others, a big source of inspiration and someone who was fearless, like totally fearless, and not really into making any sort of concessions or commitments compromises that. An absolutely brilliant contrarian scientist that
I love that you bring her up. Yeah,
and she wasn't ever shy to make people mad because she was just speaking really from a perspective of serious research. It's just she wasn't just within the consensus of the time. And by now, of course, many of her ideas have become part of the canon. Yeah, and then of course, there are other people like Thomas Kuhn also that are very, very important for. So there is, you know, I just want to mention this, like, because also mentioning her, and she's one of those really fascinating people that I think for the general public or for other artists who are looking for entry points between humanities to transition from the humanities into science. I think she's really one of those people who does that brilliantly.
Yeah, she's a serious scientist, but I always felt that her writing was very embodied. And to me, that's an inherently feminist kind of mode of practicing science, is that she, it was more imaginative. I love that she collaborated with her son, you know, that they had this thing. She's not nearly as famous as her ex, Carl Sagan. Like, there's so much to that story that speaks exactly to the things that you're talking about, the kind of like what we don't see, or what's pushed to the sides, or what is given center space.
Yeah, kind of, and she's not as famous as John Lovelock, for instance, in that.
Yes.
Also, right. In the development of the idea of Gaia.
Yeah, and I also think Gaia got, a bit kind of co-opted a bit to turn into a little bit away from what she was talking about. So it had a bad taste in maybe scientists' mouth, or a little bit from that. But yeah, she's amazing.
So if I can begin commenting on the question you placed. So impurity, so let me perhaps begin on a sort of basic level for those who are listening or looking at us or watching us. So the Solaris project consisted on taking sand from the Atacama Desert in Chile, which is the driest place on our planet, the oldest desert in the world. And this sort of like in a truthful way and otherworldly sort of place on Earth, to the point that, as many people know, NASA tests the rovers for Mars at the Atacama Desert. So I decided to go to this place, which has been actually, there are really prominent astronomical observatories, pre-Incan actually, that been in that desert for thousands of years. So it's a place that has a very interesting connection to what is beyond our atmosphere. And so I went there and I gather several kilograms of sand, and then I decided, precisely as you mentioned, Lori, decided not to purify that sand for the following process, which was to melt it into glass, which is usually the process for making glass consists on purifying the sand, so you will have the maximum level of silica possible. And then after that, I worked with some expert into shaping this glass into photographic lenses. And so once I got these photographic lenses, I returned to the desert and photographed the desert with the eye made by itself or from itself. So the decision of not purifying the sand is, I would say, it's really relevant to the project in several ways. But the first one I would say, the impurities in the glass are evidence of the ecologies living in the desert, or mm-hmm. or the desert ecology is present through its impurities. And secondly, those impurities being present in the lenses, they actually greatly distort the images that are taken. So turning the landscape into a kind of subjective image, but mm-hmm. it is a subjectivity that is created by the matter itself, by the desert itself, by the ecology itself.
Mm-hmm.
So in that sense, the impurity is really, now that we are speaking about it, I'm noticing more and more that it's really a central element
mm-hmm.
to that project. I'm curious, like if the idea of impurity is something that that has been part of your reflections in regards to your own work or in general.
Yeah, I mean, I love what you said about that, because I mean, it's, again, it's kind of embedding what is impure within the main character or the main object, and kind of denying any separation, that separation can't exist. And what does that mean for boundaries of the body between inside and outside, between borders, things like that. And that's something I think about as, you know, I make these installations that kind of try to blur distinctions between inside and outside, and the architecture of the installations themselves. To me, I call them bodies. They reflect a body, even though they're made with industrial materials. And so the body or the wall becomes this index of this blurring of inside and outside. So, you know, you can only apprehend that side is an outside in relation to you being inside. And so what does that mean? It means that is always connected to you. And I think that is how I was thinking about this inclusion of impurities within the tool that you made through the sand as well. And that was really fascinating to me. And somewhere else maybe it was in the project description, you spoke about porous membranes, which is something I speak a lot about within my work as well, that, you know, we are always letting in as much as we are releasing out. And that constant interaction can't fully be traced. It's really messy and kind of in that way makes the inside or the self inherently quote unquote impure. But I think what you're doing in this case is obviously kind of subverting this notion of impurity and thinking about that as expressibility or as a way to refuse fixity, because, you know, as we all know, a regular photographic lens has the capacity to apprehend an image or a desert or whatever extremely clearly and, you know, cleanly. And your images are really ethereal looking. They reminded me of aura photographs. They have all these beautiful blurs. I love the line in the description saying the desert looks at itself. What does that mean to have the thing look at itself in that way? So I think this notion of impurity feels really central to the work for me when I was looking at it, but it's a kind of flipping around of what that term might normally signify. And then I think about that in my own work conceptually, but then outwardly to the bodies that we occupy, the social realities that we live in. Yeah.
Yeah, it really, it's, you know, it's a term that I think it generally from the idea of autopoiesis. Mm-hmm. And autopoiesis, although you may be well familiar with the term, let me just say it for the general audience. And it's like, basically this is a set of ideas, or rather a theory developed by Maturana and Varela, two Chilean biologists, and they have to define, as part of the research, the biological research, what is considered a biological unity, like what is considered, let's say, in this sense, a human being, or what is considered an entity, a biological entity. Mm-hmm. And this was, you know, they had to struggle with it, like really trying to define this clearly. And they basically came out to say the following, that a biological entity is a self-organizing system. It's a self-organizing system that is wrapped by a porous membrane. And that porous membrane means that this is not what racist biologists' views used to have in the 19th century, which was the idea of the white body as a pure body, yeah, separated from the environment, separated from contamination. So they really gave us, I think, a really sharp definition that tell us that we as human beings are in constant mutation, mm-hmm, with the environment, in constant exchange with the environment. And I think in a way, when I look back into the Solaris project, and this lens really hints at it, although I would say also at a sort of metaphysical level, because I said metaphysical and also critical level, which is normal depictions of a landscape necessarily require for the landscape to be depicted as an object. So basically you place the camera and you objectify what is in front of the camera. And in this case, actually what we get to see are images of how the desert looks, for how the desert looks at itself. Mm-hmm. And in that sense, the landscape is not anymore an object to be depicted, but it is rather a subject in itself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's beautiful. And I love that idea. And it made me think a lot about, and it's making me think about them again, but Elizabeth Pavanelli's writings. Do you know their work? They write about geontologies, is a term that they made that, you know, they really speak to practices of colonization and indigenous violence against indigenous communities. But to kind of take it a step further from, you know, Foucault and everything, it's geontologies takes it beyond just like which bodies get to survive and which bodies are not useful to the world. And it talks about what gets to count as a living body at all. And that, you know, specifically in many indigenous communities, that a rock is not an inert, mute object. It has a liveliness. And so your project made me think about this notion of geontologies a lot too. And I think what you're speaking to is also kind of enlivening that idea that like the matter that, you know, yeah, when you try to photograph a desert conventionally, you're trying to objectify it as though it is mute. But you're kind of flipping that around through this project in a really nice way.
Yeah, what you're saying actually makes me think of something that I'm, as perhaps many other people, calling indigenous terraforming. And it really departs, well, partially from science fiction, but it mostly departs from this, in my case, and as I know that perhaps similar ontologies may be in place in other indigenous traditions. But in the case of the Andes, there is the Tiracuna, who is the earth being. There is this really fantastic research by Peruvian anthropologist Marisol de la Cadena on the topic of earth beings. And just to briefly explain what is an earth being, let's say to illustrate this, that the earth being is a mountain, then we recognize that that mountain is a geological element in the landscape, and is an ecosystem, and so on and so forth. All of that absolutely recognizable from Western categories. Then you also have the notion that the mountain is sacred. And also from Western categories, there is a place for the sacred. So that's also translatable, let's say. And finally, and this is the earth being is also a subjectivity of its own. So the mountain is a source of subjectivity. Mm-hmm. And that is not anymore understandable from traditional Western perspectives. So so it's very interesting, because this is what I'm sort of understanding as indigenous terraforming is not this sort of like massive extractivist change of the landscape that new colonies in Mars are envisioned to be. Mm-hmm. But they're rather just the exercise of recognizing us as part of the ecosystems, as entities that are in constant mutation within an endlessly mutating world.
Yeah, it makes me think of Donna Haraway's Thulucene, which I have it written down because I was like, there's no way we're not going to talk about Thulucene at least for a second. But the Thulucene is made up of ongoing multi-species stories and practices of becoming with in times that remain at stake, in precarious times in which the world is not finished and the sky has not fallen. The unfinished Thulucene must collect up the trash of the Anthropocene, the exterminism of the Capitalocene, and chipping and shredding and layering like a mad gardener, make a much hotter compost pile for still possible pasts, presents, and futures.
It's really to the point.
Yeah.
It is hard to add anything to, but she's of course so extremely inspiring. Because I just wanted to add regarding your latest comment that actually Donna Haraway adds another term that complements really perfectly the idea of the autopoiesis, and she adds symbiosis, right? Mm-hmm. as something that was needed in that understanding that starts with recognizing the view of Maturana and Varela that heavily influenced cybernetics, also the view that we as human beings are not one entity, but we are this self-organizing system that is, and this is what she's adding, right? The fact that we are in symbiosis, like in constant exchange with other ecosystems, and we are actually in fluid, in a very fluid exchange with them, through, by means or through this porous membrane. that yes. is in the case of humans is our skin, and yeah. in the case of the planet is the atmosphere, right?
Yeah, yeah. We emerge as relations rather than we create relationships. We are relationships in that way.
Yeah,
because it's which is the a very symbiotic way of thinking of that. Yeah, I love that I was revisiting Donna Haraway through this, and I'm like, oh, I need to read that book again. It was so inspiring.
I should revisit it also. I think because I remember the time I read it being so extremely compelling and inspiring.
Yeah,
and also needed, right? Like this is the type of mindful, really sharp criticism plus envisioning that is really much, much needed nowadays. This complement, I know how you feel about it, but I personally feel that nowadays only stop at criticism is not enough. It's really necessary, but we really mm-hmm. need to develop imaginaries, because those 20th century ideologies that we inherited are really not suited for what is needed at this point.
Yeah.
So the envisioning, I think, is also a very important quality of her reflective practice.
Yeah. I have one last question for you, Oscar. Let me try and word this properly. But thinking about everything we've been talking about the project with sand, which is a very kind of amorphous substance, you know, it shifts to whatever container it is in or it's not. And then this kind of transformative process of melting it down into these lenses that then went on to make these very hazy, ethereal images, which reminded me of like aura photos, which took me on this other thread where I was thinking about spirituality. But I wanted to bring up a point. There's something that's said in traditional Chinese medicine theory that says we are a spirit with a body, not a body with a spirit. And it made me think of your work just in terms of this relationship that you have, that you appear to have between form and formlessness, through both the material interest in the sand and what you did with the sand, as well as through the conceptual explorations, things that we've been talking about, like the porous membranes or impurities, or, you know, what's left in the margins kind of thing, and how that speaks to what is decided as a form and what is formless, and when do they start, you know, intermingling and getting confused with each other. And I don't know if that's much of a question, but anything that makes you think about, I would love to hear about.
Yeah, so you know, I was thinking about the inevitable tensions between the mind-body problem,
mm-hmm.
And the way in which different cultures have framed it. And those differences are, of course, meaningful. Although I would say, what happens? I would like to place the question for us, for myself, like, or how is it that we can really traverse this dualism, and what can we use as a substitution to speak about the physical phenomena, about our thinking, about self-consciousness? And I would say that I'm tempted to think, and or going back to what we were just speaking a bit before, about this notion of constant mutation. As I wouldn't claim that could be a suitable substitute for the definition of mind and body, that whatever you think of it is quite helpful, and also problematic.
Mm-hmm.
But I would say, as a provisional sort of substitute for this dualism, I think the notion of constant mutation, mm-hmm. It's could be useful.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps that would be my take on this. And then the idea of, you know, in that regard, sand as water mm-hmm. has this quality of being capable of adjusting itself to the to containers.
Mm-hmm.
Nevertheless, in a different arrangement, for instance, we need sand to make concrete.
Mm-hmm.
It becomes, you know, extremely solid. So I'm very, very, or in the case of, you know, when you heat up sand to temperatures above or way above 1,000 degrees in centigrades, then it mutates into glass. So I'm really intrigued by, let's say, this sense of sand as the potential of sand for these continuous mutations.
Yeah, and I think the project really points to that ongoingness, which the photographs are but one mutation along the way. And, you know, it was so nice to go down this trail in my mind where the material keeps shifting from one phase or cycle to the next. Lastly, can I share one more thing? I just wanted to, and this is not a question, I just wanted to share it with you. It made me think of you. Do you know the Tao Te Ching, the ancient Chinese philosophical text? It's a beautiful text that's just full of short passages. And I wanted to read you one of them that made me think of your work and this project. But then, because we've been talking about science fiction, it's a short one. Ursula K. Le Guin was a huge follower of the Tao Te Ching, and she did a translation of the text. So I'm going to read you the original translation, which there have been many, but the most popular translation. And then I'm going to read you Ursula's translation. And that's okay. So it's chapter 43. The gentlest thing in the world overcomes the hardest thing in the world. That which has no substance enters where there is no space. This shows the value of non-action. Teaching without words, performing without actions, that is the master's way. And here's Ursula's version. She calls it water and stone. What's softest in the world rushes and runs over what's hardest in the world. The immaterial enters the impenetrable. So I know the good in not doing, the wordless teaching, the profit in not doing. Not many people understand it.
Thank you for listening to Transmissions, a podcast of the Blackwood Gallery. The Blackwood Gallery gratefully acknowledges the support of the Canada Council for the Arts, the Ontario Arts Council, and the University of Toronto Mississauga. New episodes are released with each new image set between September 2020 and June 2021. For more information, including installation images, essays, and videos, visit the Blackwood website at blackwoodgallery.ca. Thank you.